Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. The ancient Toltecs believed that life as we perceive it is a dream. We each live in our own personal dream, and these come together to form the dream of the planet or the world in which we live. Problems arise when we forget that the dream is just a dream and fall victim to believing that we have no control over it. In his latest book, The Mastery of Self, A Toltec Guide to Personal Freedom, author, speaker and teacher Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. takes the Toltec philosophy of the dream of the planet and offers a roadmap to reclaiming your authentic self. Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. joins me now to discuss how awareness, understanding and unconditional love can free us from inhibiting beliefs, stories or ideas that are keeping us from living the best life possible. Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., welcome.
Good morning, Sandy. Thank you so much for having me on your program. It's an honor to be on your show again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Now, your father, Don Miguel Ruiz, obviously is considered one of the most influential spiritual teachers on the planet. We all know he's the author of The Four Agreements, The Mastery of Love, and numerous other best-selling books that have touched the lives of millions. When you were 14, you apprenticed to him and to your grandmother, Madre Sarita, to learn how they manifested their intent to heal people, both physically and spiritually. And then, after 10 years of apprenticeship, your training was intensified, and one day, your father sent you out into the world, saying, "Find your way out. Go home and master death by becoming alive." What does that mean, to master death by becoming alive?
Well, one of the biggest fears that my family has always taught me is that it's not death. Death is not the biggest fear. Living is the biggest fear. Taking a chance, moving, engaging, going out there and taking a chance. You know, part of the reasons why we stop living is that our domestication or conditioning, whatever word we want to use, depending on the individual, the punishment for failure is rather harsh. And we've become so afraid of it because domestication being a system of reward and punishment by which we model the behavior of an individual, where if we live up to expectation, we get a reward. And if we don't live up to expectation, we get a punishment. And since we are emotional beings who experience the full spectrum of every emotion we have, the reward feels like acceptance, which feels like love. And the punishment feels like rejection, which means it's the lack of love. It's the way we've learned conditional love. I love you if. Mm-hmm. Depending on the individual and the family or the culture they were raised in, that domestication or conditioning, whatever word resonates with us, will lead to a point where we won't try. We won't try to live. We won't try to engage. If it's not up to that expectation and we don't live up to the expectation, we're not going to try. And we become afraid of even taking a step, of taking an action. And that's where we become afraid of life. So to master death by becoming alive is the moment where we conquer our biggest fear, which is to live. Death, you can say, is something that every single living being will always face. You know, we're going to a place where every relative, every person we've ever loved, admired, and engaged or in relationship with, have gone to and are joining them, or they're going to be there. So it's one of the things that happens to all of us. It's a path. Accepting our own mortality means that one day I too will be joining. So action, everything.
I think we lost you just there, Don Miguel. There was a brief pause in what you were saying. So you were talking about accepting, you know, that we are going to die, and deciding to engage in life and live it now while it's here for us.
No, because that's the thing. That's the secret to every relationship, enjoying this moment. Every relationship will end. But if we wait, if we worry about that moment coming, then we're going to waste our time when life is here, when this relationship is here. So we take that action and we move and we let go of those things that inhibit us from moving forward, which is fear or conditional love or the strength of that. So for me, that line, master death by becoming alive, is the moment where I enjoy being me, accepting me for who I am. Every summer, every decision brought me here, and at the same time, I am the youngest I will ever be. How do I want to live the rest of my life? And the beautiful thing about that is only I get to answer that question. Nobody else gets to. I do. So
and
that's where you could say, in master death by becoming alive is to enjoy being alive.
Yes. And it's interesting, isn't it, that when you say that, when you explain that, it is the most simple and the most profound thing. And yet we have such difficulty doing it. The word domestication confused me a little bit in the book, but you know, I began to understand it. And you talk about self-domestication. You know, so we get domesticated, and then we perpetuate that and inflict it upon ourselves. You know, where do you think all this begins? I mean, how did we fall into this place where we forgot?
Well, at one point, someone domesticated us or conditioned us or, you know, or abused us or loved us or conditionally and all that. They did it that one moment. But since that moment, we've been repeating it in our own mind over and over. We agree with it. You know, my dad always described it this way. If I'm the voice that's talking inside my own mind, who's listening? Well, I am. If I'm the voice that's who's listening, then who's talking? Who's that voice in my thoughts? That's me. I am. I'm talking to myself and I'm listening to myself. That's the relationship within self. If that voice that's talking inside my own mind continues to perpetuate, continues that cycle of domestication, then eventually, yes, my mother might have domesticated me. Television might have domesticated me. Friends might have domesticated me. But that happened a long time ago. Since then, I've been repeating their voice over and over in my own mind, in their own voice, and I continue to believe it. So at that point, we continue to self-domesticate, and we even take it a bit further. We actually start adding our own list. I'm supposed to be this, I'm supposed to be that. For example, an example of self-domestication, I run races, I run marathons and half marathons. To say that the only way I can accept myself is if I qualify for Boston, which is to run a full marathon in 3 hours and 15 minutes in my age group, or to PR, to do a personal best every time I do a race, then at that point, I'm setting a standard, I'm setting an expectation that if I live up to it, I'm worthy of love. And I continue to believe that, and I run it in 3 hours and 40 minutes. In my case, I run a marathon in 5 hours and 15 minutes, way below the line of qualification. If I continue to castigate myself and reject myself, I'll never see that I've improved my time from 6 hours 20 minutes to 5 hours and 15 minutes. I shaved off a full hour of my marathon time. If I don't see that, I don't see what I've accomplished. I only see what I want to see. I only see, like Don Quixote, I only see giants instead of accepting that they're windmills. Conditional love never allows me to see who I am at this very moment. It only allows me to see what I want to see. So when we create that illusion of a result that at the moment is fantasy because it's not my reality, then I'll never see myself for who I am. And that's how I self-domesticate. Because if I finish the race, I'm going to belittle myself, judge myself, because I'll never accept that until I reach it. And even if I do reach it, if one day I do reach that time, I won't enjoy it because now I have to run in 3 hours and 10 minutes. Now I have to run in 3 hours and 5 minutes. Now I have to run in 3 hours. And all of a sudden it just keeps going up and up, because one of the things that happens when we're so used to domestication is that we never accept ourselves for where we are. We never get to enjoy the accomplishment. And even if we do, it lasts 5 minutes until we raise the ante, which means that we're always chasing an elusive carrot that doesn't exist. Self-domestication is basically using the judgments that other people have given me based on their prejudice or point of view, and I continue to believe it. So one of my favorite ways to explain that is a line from Eleanor Roosevelt that goes, "No one can make me feel inferior without my consent," which means my domestication comes with consent. Someone can domesticate me with my consent. Self-domestication is the same thing. How do I give consent? By believing it. By believing it to be true. And that's how it comes in. And one of the worst things that happens, if that's what we've used to motivate ourselves, then one of the worst things that can ever happen to us is letting go of it, because who am I without that domestication? Who am I without that? How do I know that I'm virtuous? How do I know I'm right? How do I know I'm worth of love? And that's one of the scariest things people have. And that's how we continue to perpetuate or stay in that personal hell, which is domestication or conditional love, because we're never accepting who we are. We're never accepting our place in this moment in time, who we are at this very moment. So self-domestication is more powerful than domestication by someone else.
Yes.
And it's because of the permission that we give ourselves. You know, and when we realize that we've given, and that moment we have a choice to continue to believe it or let go. The best way to let go of conditional love or domestication is forgiving ourselves for ever saying yes to it in the first place. But that requires the willingness. It's something I've learned in all this work I've done, is that we heal with our own permission. So giving ourselves the permission to heal from that conditioning at first may be painful, but it's the most freeing thing that can ever happen in our life.
Yes, and that's the beginning of mastery of the self right there. Now you say that the mind is a very dangerous tool, we know that, and it's a tool that we use to inflict much pain on ourselves and others. You say the mind's main job is to dream. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, like you said, the mind can be very dangerous, and the reason why it's dangerous is because it's a very powerful thing. It's the instrument we use to navigate this world. You know, you can say that my mind is a filter that perceives and projects. That's what we refer to as dreaming in the Toltec tradition. The function of the mind is to dream, which means my mind perceives and it projects. I perceive 360 degrees around me with all my senses. And I project, as I speak right now, I am projecting what I perceive inside my own mind, what I imagine, and I'm using words to describe it. And those words come from filling my diaphragm with air, slowly letting that air out through the tracheas of the vocal cords of my throat, to the muscles in my mouth, to make something very powerful, which is words. Words are instruments and basically symbols whose definition is subject to agreement, but they're very powerful because the energy that I use to move my legs, to move my arms, is the same energy that gives those words meaning and power. So the mind can be the most dangerous tool if I've ever used it only to domesticate myself, to allow myself if with domestication and conditioning. But it can be our ally. It can be the ally, the instrument that allows us to heal. That's why it's like, when I say we heal with our own permission, is that we have a moment of clarity. And in that moment of clarity, we have a choice to continue to believe our illusion, to continue to believe all the conditions, or I let go. For example, the telltale sign that I've used the four agreements as an instrument of domestication is to judge myself for taking things personal, to judge myself for making an assumption, to judge myself for not being impeccable with the word or not doing my best. The moment I realize that I've using that telltale sign, in my case, Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., if the only way I can accept myself if I'm perfect, which is to be without any flaw, then I have to practice the four agreements such as that, which means when I don't, the castigation, which is the judgment, comes in. At that moment, when I become aware that I've used that to domesticate myself, I've become aware that I've corrupted the four agreements and turned them into the four conditions of my personal freedom. It's the corruption. If you understand how we can do that, that corrupting the four agreements and domesticating myself with that, then I can start domesticating other people because I can't give what I do not have. So imagine my wife standing right there. Honey, you're Mrs. Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. Here's the four agreements. Read it. And if you don't read it, honey, how embarrassing. You're making an assumption. Didn't you read the book? Oh, honey, I only hang out with people who are impeccable with their own words. At that moment, I'm punishing her with my judgment. A judgment is the instrument we use to domesticate other people because I'm punishing her for an agreement she never made, but I'm forcing her to make the agreement through the judgment. If you become aware of the difference between the four agreements, which is an instrument of transformation, an instrument of healing, versus the four conditions, which look exactly the same, but the difference is that the four conditions, I've used it to domesticate myself, to condition myself, to love myself conditionally. That's the corruption. So
I'm going to hold you right there, Don Miguel, because we do have to go to the break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., a Toltec Master of Transformation, who's a direct descendant of the Toltecs of the Eagle Knight lineage and the son of the best-selling author and spiritual teacher, Don Miguel Ruiz. We'll be back with more from Don Miguel Jr. after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Namaste, friends. This is Deva Pramal and Mitten. And we want to let you know that we will be in America and Canada this May. We'll be coming with our Wings of Mantra world tour, coming up the West Coast to Boulder, Santa Fe, Sedona, Scottsdale, Santa Barbara, L.A., Marin, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Escondido, Edmonds, and up to Canada to Victoria and Vancouver. You can find details on our website, devapramalmiten.com. Hope to see you there. Lots of love. Namaste.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., before the break, we were talking about judgment. You know, this has to be one of the most common and the biggest things that we that distort our lives on the planet. And it's what leads to hate. It what leads to war, division, separation, etc. And the key to judgment has to be in allowing ourselves the space to understand others, because when we understand others, we're far less likely to judgment. The trick is, how do we learn to break some of those habits of domestication and self-domestication to get to the place where we can even create that space for understanding to occur?
Well, it's a moment of clarity. You know, right before we break, I was describing the difference between the four agreements and the four conditions, and become aware of how the, you know, we're talking about how the mind can be such a dangerous instrument. it could also be the instrument of compassion. It's also the instrument of understanding. It's an instrument that becomes our ally. So you can say that the work we do is not necessarily healing the heart, but also healing the mind. And the way we do it is to no longer assign the responsibility to our mind of being our active domesticator, but giving it the assignment of being my liberator, my healer, my ally. So an example of what you're describing, actually, we were just having breakfast, and in that breakfast we're having, the restaurant at the beginning was empty, and then all of a sudden it got packed. And as it got packed, you know, they had to call in extra servers, you know, like, hey, we weren't expecting this rush, and to come in. And so as we're sitting there, we're watching, and, you know, we see that our waiter is getting busier and busier and busier, you know, and we're looking at the situation. And, you know, I mentioned to my mom that she didn't know that I used to work as a barista, as a coffee guy when I was in the university for something. You know, she didn't know I worked at a coffee shop. And I says, yeah, this is what we call a rush. When a rush comes in, it's all hands on deck. And the person was with us, you know, she said, oh, my son has just started being a server in Europe. You know, he's spending his college years in Europe, and in order to make money, he is becoming a server. And she's saying, he's learning so much from being a server. And I said, yes, being a server as a barista, it's a whole team effort. You know, it's a team effort that allows you to learn how to communicate with your partners, become in sync with one of them, learn how to timing it. It's a whole level art that sometimes when you are being the customer in a restaurant, you only see me, my food, my time, why don't you pay attention to me, my bill? And sometimes that happens, and, you know, we could become that thing. In order to have compassion and understanding and not judge, is the willingness to see what the other person is going through in life. In this case, a server. A server right now went from having no clients to just having one table. And because of that, can give you, you know, the first half of your service is, you know, good attention, time, listening, and all that kind of thing. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, the whole restaurant fills up, and that time disappears because now you have to give the same service or to everyone and food and all kind of thing. To have compassion is the willingness to take that perception of being the client or the guest, in this case, in the restaurant, and see it from their point of view and seeing everything they have to go through. And then all of a sudden, your patience increases because now you know that this person is slammed and they're going to do their very best to give all their best to everyone there, and everyone there doesn't see what this person has to go through. They only see their menu, they only see their food, and they only see, when can you serve me and me? Imagine a whole restaurant full of people like that, and you're the only one who can see that. So compassion, you know, the willingness to understand your judgment, is to take a step back and look at your environment, look at what's happening in front of this person, and you can understand. And you can say that in my life, I was able to do that with my parents. You know, when I had my first son and my daughter, I realized the secret that no parent tells other people. We parents have no idea what we're doing. We're doing the best with what we've got. And as soon as we got used to being the parents of a one-year-old, a two-year-old, they turn four or six, every birthday makes everything we know about parenting irrelevant because the child that we're raising changes. So all of a sudden, that mask that I projected of mom or dad into my parents, I took off and I saw Miguel and Coco, who are doing the very best with what they've got. I saw them as peers, and all of a sudden, I understood what they were going through. I saw them as human beings, not this projected image of what's supposed to be. So that compassion comes from understanding, you know, translating. If you haven't experienced it, watch what they're going through and understanding. And that judgment, you know, that we use to domesticate other people, to punish them for agreements they never made, is just an instrument to project how you perceive the world onto them, and they may never make that agreement. They may never see the world the way you see it. Compassion is the willingness to see it from their point of view. Right before the break, during the commercial break, the last commercial was about refugees, the willingness to see it from their point of view. The last phrase was, one day I wasn't born a refugee, I was born a man. You know, basically one day how they perceive it is what they've gone through in life, and all of a sudden they feel like they're no longer a human being. They're going through their worlds. And for us, it's very difficult to imagine losing everything, losing our home, losing our possessions, losing because of the color of our skin, the way we pray, the what we make. And it happens over and over again. You know, the refugees that came from Cuba, the refugees that come from the civil wars. You know, my uncle was a refugee from Vietnam. To see it from their point of view allows us to have compassion. But in our everyday life, and a little bit more of at home, is understanding our parents, understanding our children, understanding our spouse, to take a step back and see what they go through. You know, in the same way we take a step back and see what a server has to go through. She are doing their best with what they've got, and they're in a position where, you know, the original concept of a restaurant is to give a client the experience of being royalty, because after the French Revolution, a lot of the king's chefs were unemployed. So in order for them to live, they decided to give people who were not royalty the experience of what it is to be royal, and they start serving food. That's one of the reasons why restaurants are the way they are. And from that point of view, from that point of culture, how some of it came from that. To see it, you know, for us, when we go to a restaurant, all of a sudden we have a surge of power. Someone is serving us, and some of us get drunk with that power and start treating people badly. But if we see it with compassion and look at what they're doing the best, very best with what you've got. Your compassion will come in that moment when there's a rush, like this morning. The patience that we have for them, the understanding, you know, the willingness to not be that table that becomes a hindrance in your rhythm, changes the whole world.
Yeah.
At least you've been, my personal world.
You've been doing this work for quite a long time now, and you've been obviously steeped in it since childhood. I would say that over the last decade, the world has changed significantly. We have far more refugees. 60 million people, you know, have been taken away from their homes. We only have to look at the news to understand that there's more division and more separation occurring. As you've been doing this work, you must have noticed what's happening in the world around you, and that it's harder for people to access compassion. We read a lot these days about compassion fatigue, because there's a point at which people just switch off, because there's so many awful things happening that they just can't handle it within themselves. How do you deal, you know, in a society like this, where things seem to be devolving rather than evolving, how do you deal with that? How do you, in your workshops, actually give people that experience to bring it home, to give them those epiphanies that stay with them?
Well, it's first you have to understand it within yourself. You know, for me, the refugee thing has been happening since the very first time someone invaded someone's farmland. You know, from the moment we stopped being nomads, and farm society began to spread, you know, to cultivate. You know, all of a sudden land became valuable, and we've been, if you have a drought, all of a sudden you take the food from someone else's farm, and all of a sudden there's war, because in your site there wasn't enough food, and starvation does that, and greed and things like that. And it's been since like that, over 1,000, 2, 3, 4, 5, whenever it was when the first society split between a farmer and a nomad, a nomadic herder, we begin to see in the shifts of movements. And And it happened in America even before Columbus happened. You begin to look at the history. For example, what we're witnessing today in the world, you know, it's always been there. The yin yang has always been there. But like when the Rutenberg's invention of print, when all of a sudden knowledge became more available to the masses, you can say before the invention of the print, information was only given to a very select few. The level of miseducation was very, very high. When the press began to exist, meaning print. And a lot of misinformation, what we know now as fake news, was prevalent because being such a brand new thing, well, they can't, it must be true if it's on print. So a lot of misinformation began to happen. All we have to do, look at that, is to see in the Founding Fathers' time, the battles between Hamilton and Jefferson and their, you know, written and Hamilton's writings on the different pseudonyms and different names, badgering Jefferson and the other people who follow them. That seems to be happening. That's been around for a long, long time. Now, what's different between Rothenberg's invention and today is that the internet moves much, much faster than print does. You know, by the time it's printed, it's considered old news to the people who read their news solely on the internet, or Facebook or social media. So what we're living at this very moment is something that the world has never seen. We don't know how to really interact with this because we live in a time where information moves faster than a word, than a voice, you know, like the rumor. It moves so fast, instantaneous. We saw what happened with Notre Dame. You know, we saw it almost instantly. I was in Teotihuacan, and all of a sudden I found out that Notre Dame is burning. You know, in the middle of the ancient city of Teotihuacan, as I came back to eat my lunch, I saw Notre Dame burn all across the world in a matter of instants. Now, you can call this a new form of illumination. And what I mean by that is that I'm using the historical terms of it, the illumination of knowledge being spread. But with it comes misinformation. In a time where information is spread, people are going to hold on to their beliefs even more. They're going to hold on tighter to their attached beliefs, and they're going to defend it, they're going to protect it, because the ability to disprove it goes faster. You know, it's easy to disprove it. Just got if you look at a news article and you look at it, you read it, then you start doing your research. If it gets disproven three or four steps into research, it's fake news. But if it continues and survives over and over, Notre Dame did burn, then it becomes the truth. So we live in a time that we're relearning how to be social. And some of the turmoil that we are seeing is what we in our tradition call the mitote, 1,000 voices all talking at the same time. And the voices that are going to be speaking loudest are the ones we're attracted to. And if we're attracted to domestication and conditional love, then that's the voices that are going to be talking very, very loudly. If we're attracted to love, compassion, then that's what we're going to find. We can constantly look for it. So we're living in a time where we're not really present with one another physically, but our minds are so attached to one another that we're acting and reacting in lightning speed. We're having an emotional reaction to the left or the right, saying something to refugees here and there. Even as I say the word refugee, we can have a political argument for 3 or 4 hours about the goods, the bads, the rights, the wrongs. And all of it, half of it, could be misinformation, and the other bit, some is correct information. And there are truths and there are lies, and that's going to happen. And that's the world we live in. That's the mind. That's we're watching the yin and yang play live, not on TV, but on the internet. And we see the dark side of humanity, and we also see the light of humanity. This morning there was a very bad accident. A semi-truck ran over several cars in Colorado. That's the negative. That's a horrible thing that happened. People burnt alive from this explosion. one of the light sides, you saw the good of humanity. There was an interview with a homeless man who was in the corner panhandling it. Normally, that's a negative story in some circuits. But this guy saw the accident, got up, dropped his sign to ask for money, ran to some cars, took some people out of their cars, and took them underneath the bridge for safety. You know, we also see in the darkness the light of humanity if we look for it. In this example of this homeless man who all of a sudden dropped his sign asking for money and went for help, man, that's what humanity is. Just as there's darkness in the world where people are exploding churches in the middle of Easter, there are people who stand up and run towards to help as many people they can. We live in a time where the physical body is only witnessing this present moment in this space, but the mind is entering a virtual world called the internet, and we're witnessing so much. And here's the thing, relearning how to be social in it, relearning how to engage it, relearning how to give scrutiny to what we perceive. Is it the truth? Is it the truth that this horrible thing happened? Yes. Is it the truth that this young man who was homeless did this at this very moment? It was a story that if we can verify it later, maybe it's the truth too.
Yeah. I'm going to hold you there, Don Miguel, because we do have to go to another break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. about his latest book, The Mastery of Self, A Toltec Guide to Personal Freedom. We'll be back with more from Don Miguel after the break.
Cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. I'm sorry to have to have stopped you there because you were making some
really
important points. I want to talk about forgiveness because you make a very important point in your book. You talk about, you say that when we think of an act of forgiveness, it's almost always in reference to people we know or those who have affected us personally. But there's another type of forgiveness that's often overlooked, and that is forgiveness for the suffering that occurs in the dream of the planet. Could you share a little bit with us about that?
Well, sure. We're talking about the forgiveness of the dreams of planets.
Yes.
You know, the question is relevant because what we were just talking about, you know, how do we have compassion? How do we teach compassion? This understanding is like looking right now at this moment in time, and it's a beautiful moment, you know, because information is open and we can learn from the ancestors of every corner of the world. I can learn from the ancestors in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America, in North America, and all around the islands too. I can learn from their ancestors if the information is there. When I was younger, we have to look for it. You have to look for it and search for it and search for it in bookstores or teachers or whatever, but the information is out there to learn. At the same time, it's easy to find the negative. So it reminds me of that one old story of the Cherokee grandfather who takes his grandson to teach them the old ways. And in the middle of the fire ceremony, you know, the fire pit, the grandfather tells the grandson, "Inside of us, there lives two wolves. One, a wolf of love and compassion, the other wolf of hate and anger. They both live within us." The grandson hears this from the grandfather, and he says, "If I make them fight, which one will win?" And the grandfather answers very wisely, "The one you feed." Now, to me, that's a very beautiful thing. And when I first heard it from my host, Barbara Jose, he taught it to me. And when I first heard it, I thought, well, naturally, you want to feed the wolf of love, the compassion. That's the one you feed. But then as I continued to practice what I do in my tradition, I understood that unconditional love is the willingness to see the whole of me, the whole of who I am, which is I am both the wolf of love as much as I am the wolf of hate. And my answer that I only feed the wolf of love, that's domestication. I'm domesticating myself all over again. To love myself is to see me as the whole. And I am both wolves. Unconditional love is I feed both wolves. The difference is that I'm not going to make them fight. The cycle of war ends with me. You can say in unconditional love within me, both the good, the bad, the right, the wrong, I am all of it. I am that Miguel that gets ornery when I'm hungry. I am that guy who gets ornery when mechanical issues come up on my car or the internet. And I'm also that loving guy who takes care of my family, who loves my family, who is patient with my son and my daughter, and sometimes I lose my patience, so that kind of thing. That's the whole of me. To love myself unconditionally is to accept that I have that and I have that. And I'm not going to fight. I'm going to accept it. And I choose how to express myself. That's the difference. I am both the wolf of hate and anger, but I choose to express myself through the word of the wolf of love. And that's how the four agreements is practiced. You can say the four agreements are an instrument that allows me to have a choice and how to heal and how to clean the channels of communication. It's an instrument that in that moment of choice, I can choose not to take things personal. But to accept myself is to see myself as I am a man who takes things personal. And that's when I use the four conditions. You know, I was pretending to be something I am not. I was pretending to be a man who doesn't take things personal when I was. That's why it was so difficult to practice that particular agreement. Now that I accept the truth, I am a man who takes things personal. I also understand how not to take things personal, and I'm free to say yes to either one. That's personal freedom. And I choose not to take it personal because I'm aware of the hangover that's going to come from that choice. So I choose not to take things personal. It's a choice. Unconditional love is a choice. When I have that within me and see that within me, I can't give what I do not have, which means when I begin to see it in the world out there, I see it as a whole. The world is both that wolf of love and it's both that wolf of hate. Domestication is choosing a side and fighting for that side. And that's just going to create the cycle. That's the corruption of it all. To accept it is that it exists. There are people out there who choose to use their tradition for hate. You know, in the Toltec tradition, they are the voice of the four conditions. There are also people who practice the four agreements. I practice both. And I choose without awareness to practice the one that's going to heal. If I have that for me, I can have that for the world. The world, like Jesus said, forgive them, Father, they do not know what they do. It's a moment where some of them are blind, kind of like those clients in that restaurant that don't see the waiters and everything they have to go through. That's okay. That's who they are. But I see them, and I choose to help, and I choose to engage, and I choose. It's all down to the choice of how I chose it to express myself.
Yeah.
In Facebook, I can choose to debate, or I can choose to listen. And in listening, I can quickly say, well, that's just fake news, and I'm not going to spend more time, because it's debating someone is like trying to take a drink from someone who's already drunk. And if anyone's ever experienced that, you know it's the most difficult thing to do when taking a drink away from someone who's already drunk. It's easier to take a drink from someone who's already only has one or two drinks and say, yeah, you're right, Miguel. When they're completely drunk, we mean that they're completely attached, they're not going to see it. They're not going to see it. But I accept that they're there, and how I choose to engage it, that's the thing. So to forgive the dream of the world is to have compassion for them. They only see beyond the tips of their noses. But I have a choice in how I choose to engage. And either I continue their cycle and continue this mitote, or I choose to end it in me. And little by little, it ends around the people in my life.
Yeah. Your family have done a wonderful job of taking these universal principles and distilling them down into, you know, bite-sized pieces that really do make people stop in their tracks and think. And they're the kinds of things that do cause us to have epiphanies and do create change. You spend a lot of time with your father, obviously, and I know that you wrote a book called Don Miguel Ruiz's Little Book of Wisdom, which contains essential teachings from his lectures, workshops, mm-hmm. interviews, and from private conversations that you two have. You wrote mm-hmm. The Five Attachments. Are there other essential teachings that your father has shared with you, or that you have come to yourself, that you haven't yet shared in the same way?
Oh, there's so much. Yeah, there's so much. You know, this morning I just had breakfast with him. That's who was with me at breakfast, my mom and my dad and a friend of the family. And, he was just sharing a memory he had when he was 4 years old of watching the rain come down and imagine how people are like rain and they all come down, and sometimes it comes flooding in and sometimes it just drizzles. You know, it could be the memory might have been sparked by the restaurant that was empty. Now it was packed. And, you know, but he began to share that memory with us a little bit, and much more, of course. A lot of the lessons my father has taught me is by engaging, you know, in real life moments, in real life. You know, when he sees a moment that might resonate with me, he takes the time and doesn't explain it to me, but sets out and makes me witness. You know, unfortunately, that triggers a memory in me that my dad and I were having lunch in Santa Monica Boulevard in 2004, 2003. And all of a sudden, there was a pandemonium coming in from Arizona Street. And we looked over. And what had happened, later we found out that what happened is that an elderly man had come out of the post office and got confused. And instead of hitting the brake, he hit the accelerator and he plowed through a farmer's market. And he killed a lot of people with that accident and that confusion. My father saw that and he looked at me and says, go out there and life is teaching you a lesson. Don't describe it. Just simply witness. And he sent me out there to look at what happened. And I saw not only the bodies of the people who died and the sadness that comes with it, but I was able to hear people's stories about it. And everyone had a totally different story. Everyone had a different interpretation from same vulgarities about the elderly man, or there's the people who try to run the car and get this guy and hurt him. And at the same time, there are four or five big people, one big guy protecting him, because they saw that he was an old man, and you can see that he was confused, and he was protecting him from a mob that
yes.
was in a frenzy. So from there, I learned a lot. That the lesson I learned from that moment is actions speak louder than words, but we use words to describe every action. Meaning by that, every action that exists happens, and it's the truth. But every person is going to create their own story that they think is true and interpret it in their own way, and that's how the mitote works. From all the people who witness, everyone, I can hear them talking to the phone, some people saying, they almost hit me to, I saw it, everything to the meaning, Bulgaria, and everyone had a totally different point of view of their interpretation of this one event. So from one event, something can happen, but you can tell a thousand stories all describing this one event. The truth will be the constant in every story, but you have to be willing to listen to all the different variations in order to find that truth. It's what my dad would call be skeptical, but learn to listen, the fifth agreement. I learned the fifth agreement in that way, in that day, you know, as I witnessed for the very first time in my life, bodies being covered by plastic in the street, and seeing someone, a body below a car, one above the car, and as I'm describing it, my memory is just, it's going, reliving that moment,
yes.
and the shock of it all. But my dad saw it as a moment to life, is teaching me a lesson, go out there and learn it with respect. You know, pay respect to the people and realizing that all the stories that I'm hearing, as even the one I'm sharing, it's about me. But always remember that the people experiencing it, the people who passed away, who got hurt, that's their experience, that's their truth. And sometimes our own story blinds us from witnessing their experience and their tragedy. And that's the difference. It's the difference between the server and the client. The client who is willing to see the server dealing with the rush, and the client not seeing at all, only seeing their needs and my need, my food. How quickly can you give it to me, regardless of how many people there are in this restaurant? I expect it right here, right now. Or the people who are like, oh, the place is packed. Okay, well, this is going to take a bit longer. I'll be patient. It's the difference between that. Of course, I'm describing something that's mundane, which is in a restaurant, versus something dramatic and tragedy, as in what happened in Santa Monica that in 2004 in spring. It's still the human mind that wants to see it or not see it. So it's a lesson that my father taught me. And that one's not in the books. That memory really sparked the memory that wasn't there, but it's the way my father always taught us, and my grandmother. Both of them said, I'm just an interpreter. Life is the real teacher. Life, if you pay attention, if you're willing to step aside and let life teach you, it's the best teacher you can ever have. Just like death is the greatest teacher that you can ever have. Death
yes.
is the greatest teacher because it takes without discrimination and allows you to enjoy. It's the thing that keeps us from taking something for granted. Because a relationship that you don't witness the end of it, that you accept, oh, it's going to happen forever, then you're going to take it for granted. But in this moment in time, you have the experience, enjoy it, learn from it. Be willing to engage and be willing to be there.
Yes. I think, you know, if I took one thing from what you've said, and I've taken many, and from your books and your family's books, it is about let life teach you. If we are open and receptive to being the witness, as you say, and then doing our research, we can learn so much more than just jumping in, making judgments, retaliating, responding without even thinking. I'm afraid that we're out of time now. We've probably got less than a minute. I did want to mention that you are going to be doing a course at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, on the Four Agreements for a Better Life. Could you just tell us when that is going to be and where people can find information before we close?
That's going to be the first week of June. The first weekend is going to be my dad and my brother speaking about the Four Agreements. And then I am going to do an intensive the following week as I go into the Mastery of Self and being an apprenticeship program.
Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., thank you so much for joining us today. The Mastery of Self, the Toltec Guide to Personal Freedom, is published by Hierophant Publishing. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.